Let's see. We had two members of the Senate Judiciary Committee who placed in the walking contest. Senator Perzanski and I.
You're shameless.
I mean, really, of a whole legislature, two of the top three
and
were in the same.
And who are those two, Madam Chair?
Oh, I wouldn't want to say Senator Walker, but Senator Perzanski is one of them.
Oh, and the chair might be the other. In fact, the chair might have won that contest.
Maybe. Anyway, welcome, everyone. Thanks for indulging our little brag fest here.
Can we do three on three first?
Sure. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 303. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 303 is a bill that this committee first heard on January 24th and concerns when wages are subject to garnishment when there's a direct deposit or a similar scheme in place. Before the committee are the Dash 3 amendments and the Dash 4 amendments. And the Dash 3 amendments delete the prerequisites that are in the original bill regarding when wages are subject to garnishment. And that they state that wages are not subject to garnishment if, one, a writ of garnishment is delivered within 2 business days before the debtor's normal payday. Two, the debtor's wages are paid by direct deposit to a financial institution, or the garnishee uses the Oregon Department of Administrative Services or an independent contractor as a payroll administrator. And three, the garnishee issued instructions to the financial institution or payroll administrator to pay the debtor before the writ was delivered to the garnishee. There are also Dash 4 amendments before the committee, and what the Dash 4 amendments do is they increase the amount of disposable earnings that are exempt from execution to conform those amounts with the federal poverty line.
Okay, why don't we have Mr. Marquis, if he's here, and Mr. Gardner come up, guide us through this, if we have any questions. Dan, did you want to add anything to that?
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and an Albany City Councilor is actually in the audience with us today, Sharon Canopa. Brought this issue to me and shown that because the threshold for garnishment is attached to 30 times the federal minimum wage, which is $5.15 an hour, and has not been increased since 1996, that it's actually now below the federal poverty level for a single individual. So making the change from $170 to $196 weekly before garnishments take place get you to that federal or to that 48 continuous states federal poverty level. Actually, her difficulties when they're bringing people in Albany from transitional housing and trying to bring them from basically life on the streets back into being a productive member of society, this is, and get them into a minimum wage job, this seems to be the first thing that hits them in order to be able to stay in a home and to be able to have food on the table. We have worked out an agreement between the mortgage lenders and myself, and urge the committee to adopt the Dash 4 amendments.
Thank you. Mr. Marquis, did you want to add anything?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis, representing not only the mortgage lenders but the Oregon Collectors Association as well. We have worked out an agreement, and we're fine to move forward.
Okay. All right. Any questions from the committee? Senator Cruz.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, and this may not apply, but we've had other legislation where we've been looking at taking these forms and all of this out of statute and making it electronic, and I'm wondering if that was even considered.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, no, it wasn't considered.
And just, Madam Chair, just you know, it was for flexibility and also uncluttering statute to have the forms in another place. But
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I know the Judicial Department has worked on trying to do a lot of things electronically. I don't know that this is one of those forms that you could, because this is something that is served to the debtor themselves. the Garnet, this individual thing. So I don't know that you could actually serve this. I don't think you could do it electronically.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? Okay. We are...
Senator Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Just for clarification, Commissioner Gardner was talking about the Dash 4 amendments. Was Mr. Marquis talking about the Dash 3 amendments when he said he's in agreement with them, or the Dash 4s, or both? Or
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, we're in agreement on both the Dash 3 and the Dash 4.
Thank you.
Yeah, and both are needed?
Yes.
Okay. I'm kind of wondering why they weren't... combined.
They were created on the same day, Madam Chair.
So is there a reason why they weren't combined?
Well, Madam Chair, I believe I created the Dash 4s and was not aware of the existence of the Dash 3, so I think it's just from two different entities they're coming from.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, we worked with the debtor, I'm not sure if it was the debtor-creditor section, but the State Bar is the author of the Dash 3s, the Dash 4 from Mr. Gardner.
Oh, okay. Well, counsel, have you had a chance to go through them and make sure they don't contradict each other or duplicate? Okay. All right. Thanks for clarifying that, Senator Beyer. Okay. So we have the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 in front of us. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 303.
Senator Beyer has moved the Dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 303. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendments into Senate Bill 303.
Senator Beyer has moved the Dash 4 amendments into Senate Bill 303. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 303 as amended by the Dash 3s and Dash 4s to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 303 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection?
Madam Chair, I want to thank the parties for working this out. I always love it when that happens. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank the city councilor from Albany for bringing this issue forward. That was very astute of her to be thoughtful about that.
Yep. If it gets even one more homeless person established, it'll certainly be worth it. Okay, any objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this?
Sure, I would.
It is all yours. Okay, now we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 787. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 787 establishes that parents are liable for the full amount of actual damages caused by a child who commits an intentional or reckless tort or the offense of unlawfully applying graffiti. There are Dash 1s that are also before the committee, and the Dash 1s clarify that a parent or legal guardian of an unemancipated child who defaces property with graffiti is liable for the full amount of actual property damages caused by the child. The Dash 1s also delete the provision that makes parents liable for the full amount of actual damages caused by a child who commits an intentional or reckless tort other than the one that involves defacing property with graffiti. So the purpose of the Dash 1 is to limit the scope just to making parents liable for property damages caused by graffiti.
Okay, so it's gone from a tort law to a graffiti law. Okay. Stan Newland. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, member of the committee, my name is Stan Newland, and obviously I'm from the Beaverton Police Department. Our address is 4755 Southwest Griffith Drive, Beaverton, Oregon. And I'm here in support of this bill, obviously. I think all of us would have to agree that graffiti is, I don't want to say running rampant, but it sure is increasing. In our community, we work very hard as a police department and as a community to try to curtail that. Historically, graffiti has been somewhat minimal in size and cost. I shouldn't say minimal, but much less than what it is today. where I think the way that typically it works is that the juvenile department, through the circuit court or juvenile judge, has part of the punishment is the restitution. But we're finding that more and more of this is becoming much more costly. And this really came to, I guess, to our attention when we had three very significant incidents of graffiti in the city of Beaverton. Two of those were high school. I don't know if you've happened to see it on the news, but South Ridge High School and Sunset High School, both this year, got hit pretty hard. Significant amount of damages cost to repair that. We had a pizza parlor, a Silver Dollar pizza parlor as well, that basically got trashed with this stuff. In talking with these victims and in the community, that came up was that the difficulty in understanding why the only restitution was coming mostly from kids, from the folks who had committed these crimes, and their concern was is wanting to make these parents more responsible for their kids, and by allowing that to happen to a higher degree of cost, it allows the victims in these cases to have get restitution in a much more timely manner to make these repairs. When they have to go out and hire a lot of obviously painters, but equipment and all that, it increases the cost quite a bit. We're basically victimizing both of these. What we would like to advocate is that it's left up to the judge on their ability to pay from the juvenile and for the parents, the ability to, if there's money there available, to be able to make the restitution much faster, much quicker. We would like that to happen. These, like I said earlier, these costs are continually increasing. And from a police perspective, we always think anytime we can hold the parents a little more accountable for their kids, their interest in what those kids are doing seems to increase right along with that. Our goal here is obviously not to have the repairs done, but to hopefully have a little bit more parental guidance ahead of time so these things aren't happening. I'm not here to say that all this graffiti is from juveniles, but a good portion of it is. And that's kind of the goal of this. We want to make the parents realize that they're going to have to monitor their kids, have a little more interest in what they're doing, and try to keep this from happening as much as it is currently.
So right now, if you catch an adult, which I presume for the purpose of this is anyone over 18, you can already get the restitution from them?
Correct. You just wouldn't be able, obviously, their parents, it would be entirely up to them.
Right.
One of the things we found is that, even as juveniles, it seems like they may have to pay the restitution, but it just dribbles in. Obviously, they have usually not much of a source of income. Mm-hmm. And then when they turn 18, it just seems to kind of slow down to go away.
Okay. Any questions?
Yeah, I have a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Officer, would you... I'm just concerned that, you know, the parents are going to get stuck with a bill. What's happening to the kid? I mean, are there any fines against the child? Are they split between the two of them? Or, you know, is the fine to the child and the parents ultimately responsible? I just want to make sure these kids aren't...
I know that juveniles' goal is to rehabilitate the child.
Right.
And I think they hold them as accountable as they humanly can, even with the restitution. I think that the parents is, and that's why I kind of started out, I think that the costs are getting to be much more than a juvenile can deal with. And that's where the parents come into. I can't imagine that this would leave the child unscathed, so to speak. I think it would cause the parents to pay. And how much the parents pay now, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, even though the child might have to be making the restitution, we don't know if it's coming from the actual child's funds, if he has any source of income, or from the parents. But this would make it to where the parents would be obligated to make sure that that restitution does get paid.
And there's nothing in here to stop parents from their own methods of getting restitution, correct?
That's true, Madam Chair. I mean, I've got to think about all those kids who don't have parents who are very attentive, or some of these homeless kids that don't seem to be connected to a parent.
Yeah.
Well, this would not affect homeless kids, right? You have to be able to identify a parent or guardian, right?
That's my understanding, yes. Madam Chair, I can only speak for myself. I can tell you my father would have made sure every penny I had was going towards it before he would be putting out money for this.
If I had survived, actually. So.
That's very true.
Now, don't incriminate yourself. We know about that yesterday.
Yeah, we're trying not to incriminate ourselves for at least one day. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This may be more for counsel, because it's current law. I mean, they're talking about the parent who is not entitled to legal custody of a minor child. And I guess I'm wondering, in case of a divorce, one parent has legal custody, the other parent may have quote-unquote legal custody if it's defined visitation, but I'm not sure outside of defined visitation, if it's with the non-custodial parent, where the liability falls.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Madam Chair, that's lines 19 to 20 on page 1, right? However, apparent it was not.
Yeah,
I'm not. I mean, I guess I would go to the definition of legal custody, and if visitation includes that, then they would then be liable. But I'm not. I don't have a definitive answer of whether it would include in that circumstance.
Well, I know what I'm talking about. The question is on what's current law already. I understand that, but I'm just wondering if the parent who has legal custody is on the hook, even if the child is under the physical supervision of the non-custody parent.
That's correct. That's the way this would be interpreted, because legal custody and physical custody are different things.
Right.
Right. And it does say the court may find the parent, legal guardian, or other person lawfully charged with the care or custody of the youth offender. So I do think that person would be on the hook.
Okay. That might do it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
The last counsel just confused me about who is the other person lawfully charged with care or custody of the youth liable offender. Does that mean that the person who is actually, in the case of a non-custodial parent who has the child for a weekend, is that the person who is lawfully charged with the care or custody of the youth offender, or is it still the custodial parent?
Or to further confuse, let's say they're on a... on the baseball team, they're on a 3-day trip and they do something and they're kind of under supervision of the coach. Is the parent still on the hook for that sort of activity?
I presumed that when they use the word custody, I guess the care or custody of the youth offender, they mean so in the sort of family law sense of having custody of the child and not... sort of you signed a form allowing someone to go on a field trip for a little while. That's what I presume that this was meant to do. I don't know whether it's been interpreted to be broader than that, but my reading of this is when you say lawfully charged with the care, they mean charged by a court of law or something like that. That's how I read it. But
this doesn't refer to supervision. It refers to custody.
I know.
So even if they're on a bus, if they're on an out-of-town trip or under someone else's supervision, their parents would still be liable.
Right, and Madam Chair, that was probably a stretch, but clearly if they're with a non-custodial parent, and that non-custodial parent was to say, just go wild or whatever, tell them, there may be an issue there, I'm just not sure if there's remedy.
And I would also add, I'm sorry,
well, I just say the issue would be that under current law, the custodial parent is limited to $7,500 in damage if it's graffiti. And this removes that.
That's correct. And there's also, it says parent, legal guardian, or other person lawfully charged. Right? It seems to be saying, other person is referring back to people like parents or legal guardians, and that's why I presume lawfully charged meant, you know, a court of law. Someone had legal custody of somebody. So even if there was another parent who didn't have lawful custody but had physical custody for the weekend or something, I still believe the other parent might be on the hook.
So if it was a foster child, then maybe the foster parent.
Yeah, that's legal status.
Sure. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, that's all. Thank you. That gets way out of my realm real quick.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it's in ours.
that's why judiciary is so much fun. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Steve Murrell and John Powell.
Madam Chair, the Dash 1 amendments take care of our concerns.
You want to come and see that? Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies, and with me is Steve Murrell, claims attorney with State Farm. And Madam Chair, the Dash 1 amendments limiting it to graffiti answer the concerns we have.
Okay, and why does a narrower approach satisfy your concerns?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Steve Merle, an attorney with State Farm Insurance. When we first saw this, it opened up liability wide open to any type of event that would have occurred, and that was a problem for us because of the wide range that kids get involved in things. When you narrow it to graffiti, it's something that we feel that narrow scope is something we can deal with.
In terms of actuarially speaking?
Yeah. Well, it also makes it a restitution issue, and it totally resolves our issues.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, I have a question. I was thinking about this. Can the parents make a claim on their homeowner's policy?
Chair Burita, Senator Walker, in some cases you can. Typically what we run into is, let's say, a reckless act, somebody pointing fireworks the wrong way and burning somebody's house down, that sort of thing, or injuring someone. The parent typically picks up coverage from their homeowner's policy for that liability.
Oh, I see. So if they went and painted graffiti and were subject to the restitution, then could they file against their homeowner, or would they have to have an umbrella policy for that?
Chair Burdick, that's an open question, I think, in Oregon right now, because when you fall in the realm of restitution, you're really looking at a criminal penalty that I think, as the officer testified, a component of that is having the perpetrator pay it back for corrective purposes. And there's a public policy argument that type of thing is not paid back by insurance because it would subvert that public policy.
Mm-hmm. Which makes sense.
But there's also, Madam Chair, a charge to repair. I mean, generally there's a fine for doing the bad thing, and then there's restitution for fixing the problem. So that seems like that would be insurable. And every smart parent in Oregon, a parent of a teenager, should be having an umbrella policy.
Madam Chair, can you insure against an illegal act?
Yeah, we can insure against negligence, but I'm not sure criminal.
Yeah. Chair Burdick, just to kind of explain, to kind of maybe roll this back a little bit so we can get a better view of it. There's a longstanding public policy with liability insurance against insuring for intentional acts. Liability insurance does not pay for intentional acts. In this case, what happens is a child goes out and perpetrates an intentional act. That's not covered. The child is not getting coverage or any help from us whatsoever. The parent, however, on how we have designed our product, is considered an innocent insured. Mm. And they pick up liability coverage for their liability. And so we have instances where children will go out and commit intentional acts, and the parental liability statute that imposes a limited amount of liability, I think the concept behind that is that limited amount of liability typically takes care of an injured party's own deductibles for the physical damage to their property, or co-payments if they had health insurance if they were injured, so that between what the parent's liability is and probably what the own person's insurance is, that person comes out made whole. That risk is out there in the public, and it gets just shifted that way. With this being narrowed basically just to the graffiti incident, it doesn't cause us the concerns that we had. Where it's wide open, it's anything that children get involved with, that's where we had more of a
concern.
But
you raise an interesting point, because if you're the parent, you're made liable for the whole thing under this bill, for the whole cost of graffiti. Whereas before, if the restitution judgment was against the child, you wouldn't cover that because it was an intentional act. But you will cover it if the parents...
Chair Burdick, I don't think that that is a clear question or in law, because a restitution judgment is more like a criminal penalty, like a traffic fine, that also wouldn't be insurable.
It's would be uninsurable?
Yeah, would mm-hmm. be uninsurable. Mm-hmm. So typically, if you get in an auto accident, we take care of the damage to the property in that negligence sense, but we wouldn't pay your traffic fine. I think this restitution judgment falls in that area.
Okay, even though the parent is not the one who did it?
Correct.
Very interesting. Okay. So just to play this out a little bit, so if it's my house and I'm an insured person and the kid next door comes and puts graffiti all over my house, then what does the insurance cover?
Chair Burdick, what's generally going to happen is that there'll be two things that happen. Is you'll have your own insurance in your own house. Typically, you'll have a deductible these days. $500 is a very common deductible. You'll probably report it to your company and pay your deductible and get your property repaired. Then your insurance company will go back against the child next door and try to make recovery of not only your deductible for you, but also to recover the payments that they made out, so that ends up being that person's responsibility. If they have insurance under the parental liability statute, it could transfer that liability over to the parents, and the parents would also then help pay that back, so maybe you'll get your deductible back quicker.
Okay. Thought it was just a simple little bill.
Okay, yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 787.
I
want to think about this for a little bit.
About this one.
And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 345. Council. Thank you, Officer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 345 requires a judgment creditor who seeks a sale of real property under a writ of execution to provide the sheriff a list of all interests of record who hold a priority lien. The bill requires the sheriff to provide written notice of the time and place of the sale to all interests of record who hold a priority lien and to include in the notice the list of such persons.
I don't have anybody signed up, but I have somebody in the audience who looks like they might want to testify. So would anybody like to testify on this bill? Nobody?
A public hearing without any public?
A public hearing without any testimony?
It seals the fate of this bill, doesn't it?
What?
That seals the fate of this bill, doesn't
yeah.
it?
I guess so. Nobody wants it. Nobody gets it. Oh, excuse me. I blew it. I remember now. Senator Perzanski had somebody lined up to come and testify for this bill.
Oh, that's right, at the request of Roy Klump.
That's right, and Roy is not here in the audience. They tried to reach him and get him not to come. He apparently did not come. If he had come, we were going to do this bill. So,
okay.
My apologies.
Well, Senator Perzanski's not even here.
We will put this bill over, move this bill over till... tomorrow's agenda, and then we may move it beyond that, depending on what Perzanski
sometime in July or something.
No, really, this bill is an important bill. We just it's the chair's bad here.
13th in December, is that
so? We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 345. Thank you for your indulgence, committee.
We need emergencies for February, so
incriminating yourself.